This is Jay from Pot Stirrer Podcast. I want to tell you about the Pot Stirrer Podcast YouTube channel. We have simulcasts of the audio podcasts, and occasionally we post content that you can't get anywhere else. Check out our newest YouTube exclusive that takes a look at why the NRA, the largest Second Amendment lobby group in the country, is not speaking out about the case of Philando Castile, a legal gun owner killed by police in Minnesota. Thank you for listening and sharing. Now, time for the show. Pot Stirrer Podcast, where politics, religion, and history collide. And it's not always polite. Mark Penn and Andrew Stein came out with an op-ed piece in the New York Times on Thursday entitled, Back to the Center, Democrats, making the argument that the Democrats should move away from the left and to the center. When I read it, though, it was clear that Penn and Stein were arguing that the Democrats should become conservative. Buzzwords like fiscal conservatism and straw men like identity politics, equality of results, and government handouts. It read more like the GOP telling the Democrats, get like us, than any real advice the Democrats should take seriously. And this was coming from Penn, who was an operative for the Clintons. President Harry Truman said it best. Given the choice between a Republican and someone who acts like a Republican, people will vote for the real Republican every time. Strangely enough, it reminds me of something I experienced nearly 2 decades ago. When I became a Christian my first year of college at The Ohio State University, my friends and I attended a megachurch right outside of Columbus. It was a conservative evangelical church, and the pastor was a televangelist who was and still is famous in those circles. This was about 99-2000, so this was right before Bush v. Gore. So as the 2000 election got closer, the faith-filled messages from the pulpit started turning to quips like, I pay more in taxes. Of course I should get more tax cuts. And saying how important it was to save the babies. Then one day, the pastor said, I'm not going to tell you how to vote, but abortion is the only thing that matters. I am your host, Jay Poole. We live in an age where truth, integrity, character no longer matter. We continue to support men without chests in the halls of Congress. We have a president that tweets himself wrestling a national news organization, and that national news organization doxing a private citizen. And lobby groups like the NRA calling for civil war because many Americans have chosen to protest injustice. We have an ineffectual media, ineffectual institutions, ineffectual leadership. At the same time, the Senate Republicans are working to sneak yet another version of Trump care past the American people's noses, after they have already sold our privacy to the highest bidder and are taking away the freedoms of those who did not fit the mold of straight white Christian male. And the political opposition is self-immolating because it would rather go to big business where the money is than be true to its foundation and go where the votes are. They would rather demonize Bernie bros than acknowledge that the neoconservative in sheep's clothing third way is rendering the party extinct. Democracy in America is fading. I absolutely detest both sides talk, because it tends to lead to whataboutisms and false equivalencies. But the fact of the matter is that both sides have been leading us to this logical conclusion for a very long time. While white evangelicals and Democratic leadership may seem like very different groups of people, they did the same thing that led us here. I've got two words for you. They compromised. The Clintons were the standard bearer of the Third Way, a movement within the Democratic Party to move away from the New Deal and the Great Society, the step away from progressive ideals and an alliance with labor, to champion the cause of Wall Street and move further to the right politically. Remember, in the early 1990s, the Clintons came to the national stage from Arkansas, a southern state, and Bill Clinton was a conservative blue dog Democrat. What came with that was support for unfettered free trade, a boon for corporations, but a race to the bottom for workers' wages and ultimately a jobs killer for well-paid unskilled labor. What came with that was support for tough-on-crime measures like mandatory minimums, three strikes laws, and a continuation of the drug war that coincided with broken windows and stop-and-frisk policing, all targeting people of color and locking them up in private prisons for petty crimes that most white Americans could do without worry about losing their freedom. What came with that was an exodus of Americans out of the Democratic Party, either to become disengaged or to leave GOP light for the real GOP. Penn and Stein claimed that the Democrats lost voters as the party moved left the last 8 years. I don't know what party they were looking at, but it sure wasn't the Democrats. The fact is that the Democratic Party has been shrinking for over 20 years. Bill Clinton never won a majority of the popular vote, not in 92 nor in 96. He won a plurality more than his opponents, but he never got more than half of the overall vote. The reason he won was not because most people voted for the Democrat. It's because conservatives split their votes between the Republican Party and Ross Perot. The Democratic Party is shrinking because they have become ersatz Republicans, not because they have gone left. How can third-way loyalists like Penn and Stein blame Bernie Sanders when he isn't even a Democrat? He was popular among voters, Democrats, and even some Republicans because he had actual ideas, many of which are much closer to what the Democrats once were and would have been in an alternate future that did not include the third way. But instead of embracing a way forward with real ideas and a move back to the foundation of the Democratic Party, which brought us advances like the New Deal and the Great Society, we have the third way types wanting the party to compromise. They want the Democrats to move further to the right, meaning forget supporting unions, supporting civil rights and equal opportunity and treatment for all, and work with Republicans to focus on economic policy that enriches the 1%. Instead of a single-payer system, which would be a real solution to healthcare that would be great for individuals, families, and employers, we got the Affordable Care Act, federalized Romney Care developed by the Heritage Foundation and sponsored by Big Pharma, a Republican plan that the Republican Party still whined about for years because it was pushed by President Obama. And the GOP is now pushing a tax cut plan that will make the healthcare system worse than it was before the Affordable Care Act. Folks, this is what happens when you compromise. Pot Stirrer Podcast will be back after this. Did you know for today's episode? On June 26, 2017, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that they will hear a case involving a baker in Colorado that declined to serve a couple because they were gay and the cake was for their wedding. The baker, Jack Phillips, cited First Amendment protection of religious freedom in his choice to violate Colorado statute making discrimination based on sexual orientation illegal in public accommodations. Lower courts disagreed, stating that serving the couple, David Mullins and Charlie Craig, was not the same as endorsement of the couple's homosexuality. Many observers believe that by the U.S. Supreme Court taking the case, it may be signaling that the court may be willing to rule in favor of religious conservatives based on a religious freedom argument and reverse itself on issues such as same-sex marriage and abortion. But did you know that the religious right was founded on support for racial segregation, not opposition to abortion? Randall Balmer, a professor of religion at Dartmouth, spotlights the history that is not widely known about the Christian right's origins. When schools in the South were desegregated in the 1950s and 60s, pro-segregation whites looked to circumvent school integration by founding segregation academies, whites-only private schools that claimed tax-exempt status and were able to accept tax-exempt donations as registered charities. In Holmes County, Mississippi, in 1969, the founding of three segregation academies led to the white population in the public school district decreasing from 771 to zero in just 2 years. The U.S. District Court case Green v. Connolly came out of the Holmes County situation in 1971, which led the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS, denying tax-exempt status to segregated institutions and not allowing donations to them to be considered tax-deductible. This was a problem for evangelical leaders like televangelist Jerry Falwell, who headed his own segregation academy in Virginia, Lynchburg Christian Academy, now Liberty University. Later, in 1976, Bob Jones University, a religious school in South Carolina, lost its tax-exempt status for its policy regarding the admission of blacks and barring interracial dating among students. Falwell joined with Heritage Foundation founder Paul Weyrich, who had been searching for an issue that would move white evangelical Southerners away from the Democratic Party to join with Northern conservatives, who were already largely Republicans, for a more powerful religious right political movement. Ballmer points out that the pair moved to shift the rationale for maintaining segregation academies from a question of opposing integration to a question of, wait for it, religious freedom. You see, contrary to popular belief, Roe v. Wade was not the initial galvanizing point for the religious right. According to Ballmer, there were mixed feelings about it among evangelicals at the time, but no strong opposition. A famous fundamentalist pastor and former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, W.A. Criswell, said right after the ruling, "I have always felt that it was only after a child was born and had a life separate from its mother that it became an individual person. And it has always, therefore, seemed to me that what is best for the mother and for the future should be allowed." Ballmer states that Falwell and Weyrich would have been content to keep opposition to integration as the cornerstone of the movement. However, Weyrich wanted to expand the movement beyond the South. Abortion, which at this point had been legal for several years without widespread right-wing outrage, would make a great galvanizing issue. Abortion had slowly begun to make Roman Catholics and some evangelicals uneasy, as there was an increase in legal abortion in the first few years after Roe. This was viewed as an opportunity to remove Jimmy Carter, a Democrat who was also an evangelical Christian who supported ways to reduce abortions, from office in favor of Ronald Reagan, a Republican, and take credit for it. Never mind that Jimmy Carter had other problems that led to his loss at re-election, and that when Ronald Reagan ran for his first term, he did not run on abortion. As governor of California, he signed a major pro-choice bill into law in 1967, 6 years before Roe. He did support the right of schools, like Bob Jones University, to discriminate based on race without losing their tax-exempt status during the campaign and into his presidency. So, for the founders of the modern religious right, opposition to abortion was not about a sincere belief in pro-life principles. Abortion was an issue of convenience. Now, back to Pot Stirrer Podcast. I spent most of my college years in campus ministry and in a small local church. Much of my early Christian experience was in the white evangelical tradition. Of course, many of the people I broke bread with, worshiped with, went on retreats with, and lived life with were not white. Some were, but definitely not all. Yet, the tradition I was first introduced to as a Christian, the religious discipleship and advice books I read, the pastors and ministers I listened to, the evangelists I went to see in megachurches and stadiums with friends, most were white Americans. It didn't mean that they were any more or less knowledgeable. It just means that there's a worldview attached to it, and that worldview is grounded in its history. You cannot look at how white evangelical Christians compromise the gospel without focusing on history. It all goes back to the political realignment of the 1960s. The Republicans were always a party for the wealthy, but until the 1960s, they were the party of the New England elite. That's how the Bush family became synonymous with the Republican Party, because they were coastal elites. They were also the party of Lincoln. While Abraham Lincoln was not a racial liberal, the Emancipation Proclamation was for political expediency rather than any sympathy for Southern slaves. The association of Republicans with the North meant that African Americans were primarily aligned with the Republican Party for decades after the Civil War. Martin Luther King Jr. and Jackie Robinson were Republicans. Some Black Americans started to peel off with the New Deal, but the big turn didn't happen until the 1960s. Now, the Democrats were the big tent party. They were the party of European immigrants, especially Catholics, from places like Italy and Ireland that settled in the Northeast, as well as many of their descendants. They were the party of the wage earner and the labor movement. They were also the party of whites in the South. For the South, just like slavery was everything prior to the Civil War, segregation was everything from reunification around 1877 and for the next 100 years. In the South, Blacks and whites generally lived near each other, so that whites who were in power wanted to make sure they stayed in power and that Blacks knew their place. In the North, segregation was primarily in housing, so Blacks and whites generally didn't live near each other. There was less segregation in public areas, a little bit, but not as much in the North. But that was because the segregation of the North took a different form, which had its own set of consequences. In a future episode, I'll get into Trump's most recent hot take on Chicago and why the reading of violence in Chicago, or insert any urban Black or Latino area here, as a moral deficiency is ahistorical as well as dishonest. It's worth its own episode. But anyway, the South, unlike the North, did not have the same widespread housing segregation due to the legacy of slavery. Many Black families still worked for their former masters after slavery was over. Many were sharecroppers. Poor whites also worked for these elites. But those in power wanted to stay there and did not want to give Blacks any illusion that just because they were free from slavery meant they were equal to whites. So barriers to Blacks voting were implemented, poll taxes, white primaries, and literacy tests. And segregation was imposed everywhere. Schools, parks, swimming pools, courthouses, other government buildings. The Pentagon was built with extra restrooms due to segregation. Restaurants, nightclubs, drinking fountains, and churches. Churches in the South were segregated, and evangelicalism was the most strongly rooted in the South. Entire denominations were split based on race. The Southern Baptist Convention and the Assemblies of God, both white evangelical denominations, are a couple of examples. The SBC split from the Triennial Convention, now the American Baptists, because of slavery, and like other churches in the South, enforced segregation within racially mixed congregations, which led Blacks to split off after the Civil War and form their own denomination. The Assemblies of God split off from an interracial revival movement in the early 1900s to create their own white denomination. Yes, some white Christians were against segregation, but many others in the South were for it, and much of white evangelicalism either endorsed it or were silent on the question. Instead of taking the lead, white evangelicalism in the South was complicit by their action or silence. Instead of focusing on the oneness all races have in Christ Jesus, they put race over faith and used faith to justify their sin. They compromised. So in the 1950s, 60s, and into the 70s was the civil rights movement and desegregation in the South. President Lyndon Johnson's support for civil rights legislation and the Great Society shifted Black Americans to being a reliable Democratic constituency. But the movement of white Southerners to the Republican Party was a little slower. Most did not support the civil rights bill signed into law by the Johnson administration, but they had also supported the Democrats for well over 100 years. Enter guys like Lee Atwater and Roger Stone, Republican strategists that have no problem using dog whistle tactics to coax white Southerners to the Republican side. Here's a quote from the late Lee Atwater.
Here's how I would approach that issue as a statistician or a political scientist, or no, as a psychologist, which I'm not, is how abstract you handle the race thing. In other words, you start out, and now y'all are quoting me on this. You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts your backfire, so you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we're doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying we want to cut taxes, we want to cut this, and we want is much more abstract than even the busing thing, and a hell of a lot more abstract than you know. So any way you look at it, race is coming on the back burner.
With the Southern strategy, that wedge issue of race was used to loosen those Southern Confederate-era ties to the Democratic Party and eventually move them over to the Republican side while providing plausible deniability that would keep them from being accountable for running racist campaigns. On top of that, give white evangelicals an issue like abortion, the evidence for it being treated like murder in the Bible being specious at best, but frame it like a crusade for life. We need to save the unborn babies, but not by supporting social services, economic opportunity, and healthcare. No, that is using our tax dollars to give freebies to those people. Instead, let's make it illegal and add more Americans to the prison pipeline. And with that issue being taken on by evangelical leaders and rank and file alike, while the Bible's calls to justice for the poor and oppressed were being ignored and even twisted, the church had again compromised. Despite the compromises made by Bill Clinton during his presidency in the 1990s in order to court conservatives to the Democratic Party, the religious right was on board with the Republican effort to impeach and remove Clinton from office because they wanted integrity and moral values in the Oval Office. Fast forward 20 years. In 2016, and for both the Democratic Party and the religious right, compromise reached its logical conclusion. The Democratic establishment fully embraced the Third Way and submitted a Wall Street-supported, corporatist, pandering, neoconservative shill, Hillary Clinton, to the American people. The religious right went from supporting integrity and moral values in the Oval Office in the 90s to supporting as a man of God, a thrice-married serial philanderer with a long history of bankruptcy, stealing, cheating, and indebtedness to oligarchs from a country we beat in the Cold War because he ran as a Republican. The chickens came home to roost. This is why we need to stop with the politics of compromise. Will this look the same for the Democrats and for the religious right? No way. The Democrats need to rewind the clock on their foray into the Third Way. Penn and Stein were dead wrong. The Democrats should focus on the support for labor, support unions and collective bargaining. The middle class was built off of this, not trickle-down economics, not corporate welfare for big businesses too big to fail. Support a living wage. If the work is important enough to hire for, it's important enough to pay people a living wage for the time out of their lives they are taking to do it. Support universal single-payer health care. A healthy society is a productive society. This frees Americans to concentrate on becoming successful in their careers and even starting their own businesses without worrying about staying in dead-end, low-paying jobs because they are afraid of losing their health insurance. It also allows employers to hire the best people without worrying about taking on workers based on what impact their pre-existing conditions have on their bottom line. It also gives HR departments more flexibility in the benefits they offer when recruiting the best workers. Do not give up on civil rights and liberties. Just don't let the GOP frame the conversation. As you focus your campaigns and actual legislation around the more universal policies, support civil rights and liberties as well. It is all-inclusive, but labor should always be your foundation. For the religious right, the movement has always been more about the right than about religion. It should be about the religion, or in other words, the faith. The faith according to the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. The faith according to Christ. The faith according to the Word of God. As Christians, we should be led by the Word. We should not be led by society and then find ways to use and abuse the Bible to justify it. Does that mean that Christians should all become Democrats? No. Great arguments by Bible-believing Christians have been made that support conservative, progressive, and other ideological approaches for the political issues of our time. The means can be debated in good faith, but the ends are clear. Matthew 22:34-40. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." Folks, anything else is compromise. Pot Stir Podcast is on iTunes and Google Play. Subscribe, and if you enjoy the show, please leave a review. Like Pot Stir Podcast on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at PotStirCast and Instagram at PotStirPodcast. I'm Jay Poole. Let's fight for America's future, because freedom is not free.